Tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summermusicraffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up next on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather interviews Timothy Denevi, author of Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's manic 10-year campaign against American fascism. And at 11, it's Between the Covers. They interview Kenji Liu, author of Monsters I Have Been. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
The Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Joining me on the line is Timothy Denevi, the author of the book Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. Welcome to the show, Timothy.
Hi, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's quite a pleasure to have you on the air. It's been something I've been wanting to do quite a while since I first read the book. You wrote in the book's preface, quote, "In writing about the past, I'm, of course, expressing in some manner my own concern for the current state of our institutions and ideals." Is that what motivated you to write the book about Hunter, or is that something that you caught doing yourself in the process of writing the book?
That's an excellent question. I was always a fan of Hunter Thompson, especially his more seriously investigative journalistic work, like Strange Rumblings in Aztlan, a great essay by him in 1971. And so I'd wanted to write a book about the sort of arc of his political awakening, development, and career as a journalist and activist. But on November 8th, 2016, I was at the Trump Hotel watching everybody celebrate as the needle turned and the votes came in at 9 p.m. Eastern. And that sort of put a lens on everything that I'd been doing. And I began to realize that Thompson's pursuit of justice and his ability to hold accountable the most powerful people in this country, no matter what side of the aisle they might be on, kind of became the new center point of the book for me. The election and what preceded it and what followed it has sort of put a lens on what I wanted to say and do. And as a result, I wrote much of the book in 2017. As the Trump administration was kind of fully coming into being in its first few months.
One of the signs that Hunter is an enduring writer is that his words still translate to our time, and your book captures that perfectly. This is a clip from Jeremy Scahill's podcast, The Intercept. This was his intro to one of his shows called American Misdirection. I don't know if you heard it, but I'm going to play it for you right now.
Good.
Oh, and there it goes. And let's get my computer up and going. Sorry, we're just having a little bit of technical issues at the moment. Let's try that one more time.
Memories looming up out of the time fog. Just press play. Trump.
I remember thinking, Jesus, what a terrible thing to lay on somebody with a head full of acid. I knew I was
And I'm in the White House and I was lonely. I said, let's go to Iraq.
Terrible things were happening all around us.
But they are on mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
There is no way of explaining the terror I felt. I was pouring sweat.
He's bad.
Get a grip.
He's a bad, bad...
Pretend it's not happening.
The Attorney General says I'm going to recuse myself.
Maintain.
He asked Russia to go get the emails.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
How many nights and weird mornings have been going on?
God bless you. God bless
the United States of America. Thank you for it.
Madness. It made no sense at all.
And then it starts into the introduction of that particular episode of Intercepted. Is that kind of I've listened to that 50 times at least. Is that kind of the remix in your head that you were doing as you were writing that too? Or
yeah, I mean that's a really good point. I like to think that Richard Nixon tried to keep hidden the werewolf in him, and Thompson, of course, saw it from the start. And what blew my mind, following the 2016 election, I was at the conventions, and I was at the inauguration, was that Trump ran openly on being a werewolf. He's like, I'm a werewolf. Yes, vote for me. I'm a monster. And people did. And that, I think, is what's almost more terrifying about this present reality. I felt I almost had to leave 2017 and parts of 2018 and go back into the past where at least there were horrible things happening, but they already had happened in 1968, in 1964, in 1972. I don't think it would be possible to write about American injustice right now and not have on your mind really the gruesome political situation that we are in and continue to be in, and the harm that's being caused by it. And I mean, what great American writers have done, great writers all over the world, but great American political writers of the 20th century and of the 19th century and of the 21st century, they're fantastic at often using even their own subjective reality as sort of a rock for all of us to stand on with them. And so we can say, yes, this is horrific. Look at it with me. And together we'll try to find a path forward, maybe back towards the justice or the ideals that we feel have been lost. And Thompson did such a fantastic job about that with Richard Nixon, with Mayor Daley, with Barry Goldwater, and with the other politicians that he wrote about.
Because I think he had a quote on his din or someplace where it says the fiction is a bridge to truth that the mechanics of journalism can't reach.
Yeah, I mean, he wanted to be a novelist and had written, as Thompson fans will know, novels when he was younger. But when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, Hunter Thompson was living then in Aspen. This was before he moved to California and then back to Aspen. And he wrote in letters that night. He couldn't sleep. He was worried there was going to be an attack on a Soviet satellite. He was worried about how power was being transferred through violence within the American political system to a new to a vice president, who hadn't been voted in, and whether or not he was worried Barry Goldwater now had a path to the nomination. He was worried that Richard Nixon could come back out of the wilderness and take power, and he was right. And so that night he wrote to his friend William Kennedy, a great novelist, who wrote Ironweed and would win the Pulitzer Prize. He wrote, I need to be in the arena. I don't think a novel right now can allow me to participate or capture the horror that's happening in the American political world. And so he decided to continue with journalism. He had been doing journalism and become the West Coast correspondent for a magazine called The National Observer, which he was working for. So he went to San Francisco, and he was able to be there at the 1964 Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace, where Barry Goldwater said, "Liberty in defense, or extremism in defense of liberty, is no vice." And he watched Thompson watched all of the delegates erupt around him in this violent, terrifying cheer and howl. And it was as if he was seeing at that moment the horror that always lurks beneath our political system, and that often leads to violence, which is a lot of what the 1960s were about, was political violence.
If Hunter was alive today, what would you think he would say about a Trump rally, since he did survive Barry Goldwater at the Cow Palace in San Jose?
Well, I think he would be really astute about it. Some of the great writing that Hunter Thompson ever did was about Wallace's campaign for president in 1972. And George Wallace ran on a similar populist platform, which mainly opposed school busing, mainly opposed integration. And Thompson went in 1972 to Serb Hall in Milwaukee, and he watched a Wallace rally, and he watched Wallace whip into a frenzy everybody that was there. And he saw that there were people across a much larger section of our society than we might think, kind of whipped up into that frenzy by Wallace. And there were people to whom and otherwise might have had a decent point of view on equity, race, fairness, really buying in to Wallace's populist arguments. And so I think Thompson would have been disgusted by a Trump rally nowadays, but I think he also would have understood the inherent carnival barker populist motivation that Trump buys into. And it was the same thing with Wallace. People thought he was authentic. You know, he was a terrible racist and a bigot, and he was a terrible person. But he would go to the Daytona 500 and speak for 10 minutes, and that would be better publicity for Wallace than all of the other candidates trying to go through Florida to campaign for that primary. And it was a lot like how Trump kind of co-opted the system to get the most attention possible. Wallace was doing that, and if Wallace hadn't been shot, I think, in 1972 and during the primary season in Maryland, he would have been a formidable opponent at the Democratic National Convention in Miami. And I think that gets forgotten too, but Thompson understood that threat and understood the appeal from the start.
What is it about authenticity? I remember before Norm Macdonald went over to Netflix on his old podcast on YouTube, he was talking about how in All in the Family, Archie Bunker was a more authentic, lovable person in that whole show, but he was a racist like Wallace. Like, why is authenticity around relegated to open bigots?
I think ugliness has been a saleable trait in American politics for a long time. And ugliness can be seen as authentic. I mean moral ugliness. Kind of the ability to say the most extreme thing or the worst thing. I'm not talking about like our late 20th century, early 21st century identity politics or PC culture. I'm talking about like almost a good snake oil salesman or carnival barker, that there's something deeply dishonest and ugly and appealing in that American caricature. And certain politicians just tap into it. Certain media figures tap into it. And it's an ugliness in our character. It's an ugliness in I think the difference between the ideals of this country, its democratic foundations as a republic, and its history and practice as a slave-owning, often genocidal, often militaristic in our past polity. And in that difference, it's like how Thompson loved to quote T.S. Eliot, "Between the idea and the reality lies the shadow." And that's a quote that he was using a lot and when he was writing in the late 60s and early 70s, and it really does capture this kind of double perspective of the American Republic and how it stood for the last over 200 years.
Before Hunter's big breakthrough with the books Hell's Angels and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, he was a young professional trying to scramble to earn a living as a writer in Woody Creek, Colorado. Talk about how the Kennedy assassination really woke his career path up and really basically gave him a road to travel, and he felt like he should have a national voice.
That's an excellent point. I think my generation, people in their 30s, and also younger Hunter Thompson fans or people that know of him through the Terry Gilliam movie about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is an excessive version of him, and it was a version of him in the early 1970s. But Hunter Thompson, at the beginning of the 1960s, he was a journalist who had gone up and down South America reporting on different military coups, different threats to democracy there. He would write articles like "Democracy Dies in Peru, but nobody's there to do anything about it." So when he came back from that trip, he was trying to figure out what to do with his life. His wife was pregnant, Sandy, and he was in his mid-20s. And after the Kennedy assassination, he realized that what was going to happen over the next 6-8 years was really going to determine the course of this country's future and whether it would still be a country or it might collapse, like he had seen other ostensible democracies collapse in South America. And so he moved to California and he worked really hard. He was struggling every day to make ends meet. And he was also present at not just the Republican National Convention, which was so pivotal. He was there for this free speech movement at Berkeley with Mario Savio that ended up kind of morphing and giving way to the anti-war movement in Berkeley. And he ended up, he was present through reporting at the BDC march in the middle 60s, where the Hells Angels attacked the protesters. And the police had all lined up in Oakland at the Oakland-Berkeley border to make sure the protesters couldn't keep marching. And instead, the Hells Angels just came flying in and beat up everybody. And Hunter Thompson was standing right there as the police had to choose, like, wait, we were going to fight the protesters, and now we have to, like, save the protesters from the Hells Angels for beating them up. And, I mean, it just... he was at the center of the tumult, and he was very good at making himself on the page a sort of bewildered, lost caricature. But he was, in real life, as David Douglas Brinkley, his literary, the head of his literary estate, would say in the opening to his letters, he wasn't very much fun in the 60s in the way he might appear to be now. He was working very hard. He took Dexedrine, which is very similar to Adderall. He drank too much. He was an alcoholic, but he was reporting and putting himself at the center of all these moments. And that wasn't an easy thing to do as a freelance journalist, because he was not being compensated, as freelance journalists today are not compensated adequately for the effort that he was putting out.
Why did he move from Woody Creek to Sonoma instead of just going straight to San Francisco? His stop in Sonoma was fruitful in that he had met the Geigers, but why did he take Sonoma as an intermediary step?
Well, he had gone on a trip up and down San Francisco, up and down the West Coast in 1960. He was actually at a strange bar in Oregon that he knew he'd never go back to when he first watched the debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy that would become very famous and would be pivotal for him as a young man in his political awakening. And he had lived in Big Sur for a little bit. This is in 1960 and before he went to South America. So he had met friends that had a place in Sonoma, and he wanted to go there and get his bearing, because I don't think he wanted to be in the center of the city. He liked to be outside of that place and then kind of go into it to report. The problem was, he and Sandy, who was 8 months pregnant, drove for 15 hours, and when they got there, they found out the cottage had been rented to somebody else and they didn't know what to do, and so they ended up getting another cottage on the property and lived there for about a year. But he ended up getting kicked out of that because he and Bob Geiger, Dr. Bob Geiger was his good friend, who was also a writer, was an orthopedist, and was really helpful to him at this difficult time in his life when he didn't have enough money and didn't have enough support. They were up at 6 a.m. In August of 1964 watching the sunrise, and they decided to shoot at some gophers that they saw going in and out of the grounds nearby. And so the landlady of the place in Sonoma came running out and screamed at them that she didn't care what they thought they were doing. He had to move out immediately. And so because he got kicked off of that property, he lived with the Geigers for about a month. Great stories about that. Like, Bob Geiger would say that, there'd just be like three people sleeping on the floor. They'd be like, we're friends with Hunter. And he'd be like, what's your name? And he'd be like, Joni. And later, Thompson would be like, that was Joan Baez. So that's my friend Joan Baez, who was sleeping on the floor before she was famous. But long story short, he then moved to San Francisco because by that moment, he could really see the cultural revolution that was centered there and was going to take place. So he moved to Parnassus Heights, which is just above the Haight, to 319 Parnassus Street, that had a view of the Bay Bridge. And from 64 to 67, really as San Francisco turned itself over with a cultural revolution, he was there and present to witness all of it.
And as a football fan, he was next to Kaiser Stadium as well.
He could see it. Like, I think he could hear the games from his place. So he'd go down to Kezar,
yeah.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating because he was a 49ers fan, and that became a pivotal moment for him later when, in 1968, he was covering Richard Nixon in the New Hampshire primary, and Nixon was coming back out of the wilderness to run for the Republican nomination. And, you're a freelance journalist. He had had some success by then, but he was only in town for a week in New Hampshire in 1968. And, he became friends with Pat Buchanan, and Buchanan helped get him an interview. Nobody's more opposite than Thompson, I think, in their politics than Pat Buchanan, but nevertheless, they drank whiskey together. And so Thompson got an interview with Richard Nixon, and Nixon and Thompson rode in a car for 45 minutes. And Thompson was like, shoot, what am I going to say to this person? Like, I can't talk about politics with him. I already know what he thinks. And so they began to talk about football. And Thompson's experience at Kezar, living right there and, having watched so much football, he was an expert on it by then. And he found out that Nixon during that conversation was actually a knowledgeable football fan. And it was the only time in Hunter Thompson's life where he knew for sure that Richard Nixon wasn't lying, was when Richard Nixon talked about football.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, actually. We were talking about Bob Geiger and how he helped Hunter professionally. He also wrote Hunter a prescription for drexidine. Describe the effects of the drug and how much of Hunter's prolific writing output during the 60s and early 70s do you attribute to his continued use of this drug?
Well, dexedrine is a lot like Adderall. It's a racemic amphetamine salt. It's a performance sustainer. His main issue was alcohol. And so he would get up at 3 or 4 p.m. every day. And, you know, later it would be publicized he had this diet of drugs that he did. But at that time, he was drinking all the time. So he was a night owl. He'd get up in the afternoon. He'd drink. And then dexedrine would help him recover from that alcohol. It doesn't allow you to be creative. It doesn't give you insight that you don't have. It doesn't create wisdom. It floods your brain with dopamine the way that but it's cut with salt. So it's a slow up and a slow down. It's like Ritalin, which is prescribed often. And it's, again, similar to Adderall, which is popular today. But what it did allow Thompson to do was work longer, was to sit at his desk and to continue on something and to report longer and stay out longer. And so I think if he probably was just not drinking so much, that would have been as beneficial as what the drug was.
Yeah.
I mean, that probably would have been the right decision. And I think he paid a terrible price for that. His son wrote a beautiful book, Juan Thompson, Hunter Thompson's son, called Stories I Tell Myself. And it's really about Hunter Thompson as an alcoholic. And that's how Juan was able to become friends with his father at the end of his life, was to understand what it's like to be a child of an alcoholic and to live with that. And so to answer your question about the dexedrine, I think it was important because that was a pivotal moment where he seemed to be breaking down. But again, with a drug like that, it is more of a performance sustainer. To think that it allows you insight or superhuman power to do something is a misnomer. In the same way that psychedelics are great, but they're not going to give you wisdom. And I think Thompson was really astute at noticing that too. Ken Kesey thought if everybody took acid, then we'd have a transcendental revolution and there'd be no war and humans would evolve. And Thompson could see yes, but you also might end up homeless in San Francisco and not able to do anything like this. These drugs are not magic potions. And Thompson saw that in a very clear-eyed manner.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I enjoyed about your book as well is in Hunter's writing, there's a main narrative, but he throws a lot of nuggets of thoughts that could be articles or books in and of themselves. And in your book, Freak Kingdom, you tied some of those nuggets together. In the book you write, in contrast to Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, Thompson saw this drug, LSD, as an end as opposed to the means, an escape. It wasn't as if a career politician like Johnson or Nixon would suddenly sue for peace if they took acid. In fact, it was the opposite. It was the idealism of Kinsey's revolution that made the pranksters more manipulated by holding power. And then which dovetails to this particular clip from Fear and Loathing Las Vegas.
We're all wired into a survival trip now. No more of the speed that fueled the 60s. That was the fatal flaw in Tim Leary's trip. He crashed around America selling consciousness expansion without ever giving a thought to the grim meat hook realities that were lying in wait for all those people who took him seriously. All those pathetically eager acid freaks who thought they could buy peace and understanding for $3 a hit. But their loss and failure is ours too. What Leary took down with him was the central illusion of a whole lifestyle that he helped create. A generation of permanent cripples, veiled seekers, who never understood the essential old mystic fallacy of the acid culture. The desperate assumption that somebody, or at least some force, is tending the light at the end of the tunnel.
What were some of the connections you were able to make across Thompson's body of work in writing this book?
I mean, I love that clip that you just played. It's great to hear the young Johnny Depp read it too.
Yeah.
Where he's descended to now. But to answer your question about connections, I think the most seminal moment in Thompson's political development was the 1968 Democratic National Convention. And at that instant, he realized that what do we do if the people in power are not listening to us? You know, there was the belief in the early 1960s that if you protested correctly with nonviolence, that if you kind of came together as a movement, you could affect change. And somebody like Bull Connor doesn't want to listen to you. But with the civil rights nonviolent movement, then Bull Connor had to. And change came about. But by the time Daley was in power, or even later with Richard Nixon, Thompson realized that if they want to, they can use the state to silence you and beat you up and to use violence to remove you from the conversation altogether. And I think that goes, that development went right through his experiences with Kesey and seeing the Merry Pranksters taking these drugs and thinking they could have a political revolution without the hard work that, one, you have to put out, or two, without recognizing the mean militaristic forces that he talks about in that quote, that will hit you over the head with the club and will knock you unconscious, and you won't be able to affect change as a result. And I think that we forget that now, that once we lose the ability to communicate in our society, once the people in power are no longer listening to us, it means we're approaching violence at a very rapid rate. And he was so astute at understanding how we arrive at political violence and the costs of political violence. When he was beat up in 1968 in Chicago, he spent the next 2 weeks, he wrote, crying. Just couldn't stop crying. He was just sobbing all the time, because violence disfigures us. To enact violence disfigures us, and to receive violence disfigures us.
When the Thompsons moved to Sonoma and San Francisco, he wanted to be in the heart of the action and to write about the free speech movement, but he was still a working journalist, and the Nation wanted a piece about the Hells Angels, since the California District Attorney's report about the group had recently been released. I never knew about the fact that he really didn't, his writing on Hells Angels wasn't his first choice. There's so many amazing details like this in the book. How did you accumulate all of your sources?
Well, that's a really good question. I did, years of research, which were very difficult. But one thing I tried to do is I tried to read everything that was available before I began to look for people to interview and for archives to go through. So there's an enormous wealth of information and just raw material of his letters and of his own work. And on top of that, then, once I sort of laid all that out and could begin to see where the gaps were, where I needed to know more, I went and I interviewed people. I went out to the Ransom Center in Texas, where I was able to see some of his original letters. And I was able to get some other interviews with people that, like Dr. Bob Geiger, hadn't had a chance to talk about some of these specific moments yet. And then the goal of the book was to tell it in a dramatized fashion. I want it to feel like a novel. I want you to feel as if it's unfolding almost cinematically. But I also then, if that's 90,000 words of narrative, provided 50,000 words of notes. So you, as a reader, you never have to look at them. But if you have questions of how am I able to dramatize this, where am I getting this information, you can see where the material I started with, which might be a quote from his letters that says,
yeah,
I felt at that moment like I would, and then I can dramatize it in a certain way. And I wanted the reader to see that distance. And to be able to dramatize it in the way that I wanted, I needed to have both the research material and also the interviews. I think that was necessary to convince myself of the authority to create the story that I wanted to tell. And a lot of the research too was, there's moments where I think of him as a third person character I'm writing through in this book. So I'll leave him behind at certain moments, and for maybe a page or two, I'll have done a bunch of research into Barry Goldwater or somebody else. And we can kind of see the world through that person's point of view before returning to Thompson. So that was nice too, to be able to move in that manner through a kind of broader sense of research.
Yeah, the broader sense of research enables like a full context of the time and space that these events are happening, both the events that are bigger than Thompson, like the Kennedy assassinations, and the actions, as well as the actions Hunter himself initiated. It creates an immersive reading experience, which is great while you're reading it. But when I stepped out to dinner last night while doing research for this interview, it created a sadness, because the current world as it sits, with its conformity corporate culture, the world is burning and not a lot of people are actually paying attention, let alone action. What do you think Hunter would think about the general apathetic response found in the, quote, Twitter resistance?
I think he would be outraged, and I think he had a Stephen Colbert-like ability, if you remember the Colbert Report, to exaggerate people's points of view. Like in his Kentucky Derby is decadent. He sits there and he takes the point of view of the person he meets, who's like this racist Southerner who's supporting like Agnew and is just ridiculous. And he exaggerates that point of view back to that Southerner to make him feel to make the Southerner feel uncomfortable. And I think, in a sense, with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, we think he's just, sometimes when you read that novel, destroying himself, and it's about hedonism. But I like to think that he's on a conveyor belt along with all of us, and we're all kind of on that conveyor belt going into a flame, and he's waving at whoever might be looking outside that conveyor belt and the people around him, but he's also on the same path. And so he's been able to indict that consumerism. He's been able to indict the abuse of power by often showing how it destroys him as a character within these moments and scenes. And he was trying so hard to get our attention in every way, as an essayist, as a dramatic writer, as someone who would use exaggeration or imagine scenes. And he was calling out to us in a very craft-based way, regarding politics, to draw our attention to what happens when the people who have the most power in the society are not held accountable and what the price will be.
That is an awesome place to take a break real fast. My guest right now is Timothy Devini, the author of the book Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. So we're going to come back right after what else but Tammy from Debbie Reynolds. This is the Heather McCoy Show.
I hear the cottonwoods whispering above, Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. The old hooty owl hooty hoos to the dove, Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. Does my lover feel what I feel when he comes near? My heart beats so joyfully, you'd think that he could hear. Wish I knew if he knew what I'm dreaming of. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy.
Survival trip now.
The Heather McCoy Show.
All sorts of technical fun on the Heather McCoy Show. Right now I'm talking with Timothy Devini. He has a book called Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. So we left off with the Kentucky Derby piece he wrote for Shanlon's. The piece at which he immerses himself within the Kentucky gentry. One of the things that I found, and I'm a huge Hunter S. Thompson fan, I didn't realize I was doing it, is There was one time when I was living in California, I actually went to a Harvest Crusade and interviewed the people there and did a Kentucky-like Derby piece. And I didn't really realize it at the time. How much unconscious reporter, how much has Thompson's consciousness worked itself into reporters, but without them knowing it?
I mean, that's a fascinating way to put it. He went to Kentucky ostensibly to write about that race. He was at a dinner with the writer James Salter, who's one of my favorite novelists. And James Salter suggested that Thompson go back to his hometown and write about the Kentucky Derby. And he met Ralph Steadman there, a young illustrator in his 20s who would eventually do the illustrations for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and is identified often with Thompson. And, you know, his assignment was to write about the race. But when he got there, Nixon had just invaded Cambodia and was giving a speech about it. And when he left, Kent State was taking place. You know, five people were being shot and murdered by the National Guard. And he went to the Royalton Hotel in New York to finish it and to write the piece that he needed to write. And instead of writing about the race, he found himself writing about this Agnew-Nixon culture that you know, blamed protesters for being shot, that blamed people for standing in the way, that were attacked. And that basically blamed anybody who didn't have the most power in society. So instead of, you know, ostensibly going after the main journalistic story, this horse won, this is what happened, he made it a more memoiristic piece that was about the experience there. And it was the beginning of what we call now Gonzo journalism. He thought that he had failed. He was trying to make the deadline for Scanlon. He was basically ripping out pages from his notebook and reading them over the phone to San Francisco so they could make the deadline in time. And, you know, and afterwards he wrote, like, you know, this is a failed piece of journalism. I feel bad about it. But suddenly he began to get letters from his friends that said, whoa, this is a whole new way of approaching the subject. And he he's like, well, I did that because I ran out of time. And because, but the really reason he did it is because that captured in a better way the horror of the current moment. And one of his friends, Bill Cardozo, who was a journalist at the Boston Globe, wrote him a letter that said, you know, darn, Hunter, that was pure Gonzo. And it's a, there's a dispute about how that goes back, what the term's from. It's a, perhaps a jazz term that it's a reference to, but it kind of implies improvisation, and it implies most of all a kind of participatory journalism. As you say, with the new journalists in general, it took a lot of effort to get that into the more mainstream form of the journalistic world now. But if you read a piece in the New York Times Magazine, which does wonderful long form, you'll find that the author is often reckoning with their presence in the story. And that wasn't, you know, that wasn't necessarily an option. It was something that writers were experimenting with, but the way that Thompson did it, not just to be hedonistic and write about himself, but to find a new way to indict the horror that he saw around him, is kind of a gift that he gave to journalists everywhere. And I think it gets misunderstood. And I think the way that you phrase it, like when you go out to do it, we don't realize how influential that decision and his stylistic and structural conceits have become.
Yeah. Why was he always late for deadlines? Like, I remember reading something where he's always talking about stuffing pages into what he called the mojo wire.
Yeah. I think he ran out of gas. I mean, I think it's hard to be a terrible alcoholic for a very long time.
Yeah.
To drink every moment that you're awake. I think that stakes are different. He was good. He was better at deadlines when he was younger, even on pieces he didn't want to write. But as he got into his 30s and he got very successful, it became harder to write pieces that maybe he was getting a lot of money for that he didn't want to write. And finally, on a campaign trail, there was, when this is in 1972 when he covered George McGovern. I don't think I can ever understand how exhausting that experience must have been. I think you have to be on the campaign trail every day the way he was to really get the sense of, as he says, mental and physical collapse that accompanies a major American presidential campaign, both in the primary season and in the general election. And he was, I think, deeply exhausted. I think alcoholism plays a role in that. I think the way his career arc had moved played a role in it. And a lot of his letters in the, like 1973, 1974, which is when the book in Freak Kingdom kind of comes to a conclusion, are about how he wants to work in a different form than what he'd been working. The deadline motivation was good. It helped him get what he needed done. It helped him write some of the most beautiful and incandescent passages, I think, of 20th century political writing, but it also burned him out. He wanted to be in a more revisable space. He wanted to write work that he could revise and take his time with again. But I think that by 1974, his lifestyle for those 10 years had 64 to 74 taken a very serious toll on his health and his outlook in general.
Well, like the work from that time period, like he was still having problems paying money even when he did national pieces for Scanlon, because Scanlon went out of business and then stuck the writers with the bills. So like a lot of the stuff that he had to do for money was, it was quick, but it was also some of the best work he produced.
Yeah, and that's true. It's hard to imagine the credit card debt that was weighing on him. I mean, it's not that hard to imagine, I bet.
No.
He was, you know, he had people, not that hard. He had, you know, he had people coming to his house repossessing things because he had been a reporter for Scanlon, and they owed him probably the equivalent of $10,000-$15,000 today if you did a currency converter, or $20,000, and they went out of business and he never got it. And you know, that was really difficult for him, and it did motivate him to do really wonderful journalistic pieces. It motivated him, I think, to become a staff writer at Rolling Stone, which helped him financially. But you know, he was never, his son writes about this very well too, he's a person who lived in the moment. I think the writer James Salter, who I mentioned earlier, the novelist, is a kind of other side of the coin to Hunter Thompson. James Salter wrote his last book at 88 years old. It was a beautiful novel called All That Is. You know, he wrote throughout his entire lifetime. While Thompson was very much burning in the present. And he, you know, writes about how he's exchanging time now for time later, whether that's through taking dextrose, and you know, who knows if that'll burn him out for later, and I think it eventually did, or if he's spending money now because he doesn't know where he's going to be in 5 or 10 years. That immediacy was wonderful to capture the upheaval of the 1960s. He was kind of, he fit very well, I think, in terms of his personality, and this is just my opinion, what was happening culturally at that moment in America. But there's always a price to be paid for it later. And to his benefit, I think he always understood that this was the wager he was making.
Yeah, I was kind of curious about one of the literary choices you made in the book. Hunter was commissioned by the National Observer earlier in his career to do a series of travelogues in the Western United States. He turned in 4, but the piece entitled What Lured Hemingway to Catch Him was more of an abstract art theory piece. Hemingway, like Thompson, endured decades of hard living and both ultimately ended their lives with a gun. In this section of the book, you seem to imply like Hunter, like his idol before him, ended basically in the end, the world had passed him by. Is this a correct reading of these passages? And if so, I would like to submit ESPN page 2 column that Hunter wrote and the mere aftermath of 9/11 as counter evidence when he wrote, quote, "The towers are gone, reduced to bloody rubble, all along with all of our hopes for peace in our time, the United States or in any other country. Make no mistake about it, we are at war now with somebody, and we will stay with that war with this mysterious enemy for the rest of our lives." 19 years later almost, we're still in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the point when I think it's good to interpret it how you would like, because I want the reader to do that work. But two, my take on Hunter Thompson's career was that he wrote some very astute and beautiful pieces all throughout his life up until he passed away. And that column is moving and amazing. I thought his essay in 1978 about Oscar Zeta Acosta's disappearance, The Banshee Screams from Buffalo Meat, is fantastic. His piece on the Pulitzer trial in the early 1980s is fantastic. And his eulogy for Nixon in 1994 is one of my favorite pieces of writing. But unlike Hemingway, well, I think Hemingway still could produce these books, but he was kind of no longer attuned to, in Thompson's opinion, what was happening, you know, in terms of the cultural revolution that was about to take place in America in the early 60s. But I think Thompson remained attuned throughout his life to the abuses of power and how the specific American form of political vengeance and violence and war it will reoccur and is reoccurring as we speak. But I don't think he had the energy to sustain long book-length works in the way that he once did.
Yeah,
and that's the toll that really affected, I think, his output. You know, I don't think he was suddenly like lost. He understood America as clearly as anybody. You know, and I think it was different than Hemingway in that sense, but I think it's similar where when the body breaks down, the mind is part of the body, you know, and of course, if your mind no longer has that, you know, health to it, then I think you can have these bursts of brilliant work, in my opinion, but it's very difficult to sustain a book-length work, and that's why I think his best book-length works for Thompson were in the 60s and early 1970s.
To get separation between Hunter's reporting and his family life, they left San Francisco because Hunter was inviting Hell's Angels over to his house at all hours of the night. To go back to Woody Creek in Colorado, a city that the Thompsons had left only 5 years earlier. Not long after their return, Hunter meets Oscar Acosta, who recently quit his job as a public defender. Most people only know the caricature of him as Dr. Gonzo in the book Fear and Loathing. Talk about who Oscar Acosta actually was.
I mean, that's a great point. Oscar Zeta Acosta was a civil rights attorney and activist who had been born in Texas and had grown up in California in the Central Valley. And he was a brilliant and dynamic individual who had been in the Air Force, who had been a missionary, who had been a public defender in Oakland during the kind of Great Society push for social reform that was championed by the Johnson administration. And he also was someone who was very introspective and constantly you know, trying to find the best way to work within the society to make things better for other people. And by 1967, when Thompson and Acosta meet for the first time in Aspen that summer, Acosta was beginning to become disillusioned with whether or not it was still possible to work within the American political system to affect change. I mean, Acosta would say basically that you can't use the master's tools to take down the master's house. And Thompson believed in the opposite. Thompson believed that you could use the American system. And a lot of that has to do with privilege. A lot of that has to do with perspective. But they became friends, and the dynamic of their friendship was fascinating because Acosta was brilliant. He could challenge Thompson on everything. And they had different points of view about how things will work or not, whether or not you can make things better by working within what we have as our current political framework, or whether you need to tear it down and begin anew. And that dynamic, that intelligence, that friendship was probably one of the most seminal formative experiences in Thompson's understanding of justice and political power and America itself. And so by 1971, Oscar Acosta is living in Los Angeles. He's a public defender. He's fighting against the LA Police Department, who has murdered a large number of unarmed Chicano youths on Whittier Boulevard. And the police department has also just killed the most famous Mexican-American journalist in all of Los Angeles, Ruben Salazar. And so Thompson goes down to write an article about that and lives in East Los Angeles. Thompson's terrified that the strange remnants in Aztlan, he's staying with Acosta. He's terrified that the police are going to kill, Thompson's terrified the police will kill him, because if the police are willing to kill the most famous journalists for questioning them, what's to stop them from killing somebody like Thompson, who's now questioning about that? At the same time, Acosta's friends think that Thompson shouldn't be down there as this gabacho, which is a term for like white Frenchman journalist, within the barrio, within their, within where they live and work, and have to, you know, he's a tourist coming in basically. So as a result, they go to Las Vegas. Oscar Acosta is being bugged by the Los Angeles Police Department. There is a there was an aspect of the LAPD called the Special Operations for Conspiracy Division, which this is true. And so that existed. And so they got a convertible and they drove with the top down, because that way nobody can hear what you're saying. And they were finally able to be honest and find out how Ruben Salazar was killed, how the dirty cops may have been complicit. And that was the genesis for what became Fear and Loathing. The problem with Fear and Loathing is that it separates Acosta's identity from his actions. Acosta's identity was one of somebody who at any moment could be set up or killed by the most powerful people in Los Angeles. And when they get to Las Vegas, it's actually based on two trips. The second trip that they take, it's a district attorney's convention. And these district attorneys are from all over the U.S., but these are the same sort of powerful public figures that are in Los Angeles threatening to kill Acosta and would set up his eventual a drug bust that he would have. And so when we see Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, we see this angry figure of Dr. Gonzo, who seems out of control on drugs and seems very upset. But what gets lost in the context of that is that Acosta was surrounded in Las Vegas by the very people who wouldn't hesitate to either set him up or kill him in the way that he'd just seen it happen in Los Angeles, and the way that Salazar's murder was covered up. And if anybody is more interested about this, there's such a brilliant filmmaker named Philip Rodriguez, who was wonderful in helping with this book and made for PBS a documentary called The Rise and Fall of the Brown Buffalo. And it's about Acosta, and it's about Acosta's relationship with Thompson too. And I think that Acosta's been overlooked when we talk about Thompson a lot, because he was so brilliant and his moral clarity was so astute.
He was an unconventional lawyer. You write that he took an unloaded gun from an evidence display, waved it at the jury, ordered everyone to get on the ground, and ask him in a normal tone of voice, in such intimidation, should they expect to give an accurate testimony of events, like in the way his own clients were. He also challenged a white grand jury system in Los Angeles. So he was not your typical defense lawyer, to say the least.
He was brilliant. You know, he said law is inseparable from politics, and in our current legal system in Los Angeles, it is politically unjust. If grand juries are chosen by judges, and every judge but one or two out of the 120 that are in Los Angeles are white, then how can you possibly get a trial of your peers if you're a Chicano man who's been accused of something you didn't do? So he found a way to interview all of those judges and ask them what minorities they knew Mexican Americans. And there's these great exchanges of like the judge being like, they cut my grass. And when I go to my country club, they really said this. There's a great book called Racism on Trial, which is about Acosta's legal career. And it has these transcripts in it. And, you know, that's where Thompson and his exchanges are fascinating, because Thompson's like, they're going to kill you. If you keep doing this, if you keep bringing the most powerful people in Los Angeles and humiliating them, they're going to go after you. And Acosta's response was, they're already after me. I mean, what surprises you that they're going to be after me? They're already trying to do these things, you know? And their dynamic of how they talked about privilege, political violence, revolution, it's just fascinating. And I just think Acosta's moral clarity, his acuity of what injustice was, is, for me, you know, very moving and very important to, I think, how Thompson developed and how even I see justice in America today.
And then eventually Acosta does, he's part of the Brown Berets, and they do bombings in public buildings because he kind of figures he has nothing else to lose. So he's kind of going the Prout LaFell route, the Godard movie, where just like you just take it to the absolute maximum.
No, I mean, there's a great quote by his first wife, is that he lived in a mercilessly racist society, talking about Acosta, you know, and at every step, at every moment, he was smarter, he was more talented than so many people, and he always ended up back in the same place, which is under the foot of a power like the LAPD. Finally, by the early 70s, like so many other radical revolutionary or radicals within or political activists within the 1960s, begun to say there's no way to work within the system to have things go. And he had begun a bombing campaign, and he was bombing public landmarks. And to Thompson, it was heartbreaking, I think, because you know, Thompson knew that this is not a political act anymore. This is a death sentence. You know, and you're not going to be able to do this and still in any way live the life that you had once led. And again, that gets to their kind of central conversation they had for about a decade of, do you work within the system and run for office, which Acosta had done. He ran for sheriff of Los Angeles and got 100,000 votes. He lost by 1 million, but he got 100,000. And eventually Acosta realized that that's not the path that will work. And he said, you know, this is an unjust space. He believed that Aztlan, which is the southwest United States, was illegally seized during the Mexican-American War, Acosta did. And so he believed in revolution in that sense. And eventually the LAPD pulled him over in a high-speed bust. There was amphetamine. Acosta took Benzedrine, which is a much harsher amphetamine, that maybe one of his associates had on him. And the police set him up on that charge. And, you know, he eventually had to leave. He left and went to Mexico, and he disappeared in Mexico in 1974 in what may have been a CIA operation, or may have been a failed drug deal, or may have been an arms deal that went wrong. I mean, he disappeared on the boat, and nobody really knows what happened. But I think Thompson saw the unique doom that Acosta was approaching, and I think Acosta was trying to explain to him that this doom had always been there, because I'm not on the same path in the society that you are.
Yeah. Going back a little bit in the relationship, when Acosta first approaches Hunter in back in Woody Creek, that his perspective about working without the framework of the system, and then shortly thereafter, Hunter covering Chicago in 1968, did that really drive Acosta's point home to Thompson, you know, in Chicago, after he saw the violence that the police were willing to go to shut down dissent?
It definitely did. And I think that right before that, there's a great letter from Acosta to Thompson about Bobby Kennedy's assassination, which just crushed Hunter Thompson. He was a huge Bobby Kennedy supporter. And that night they had thought that the assassin was a Mexican-American. And so Mexican-Americans were being pulled over all over Los Angeles because they, Sirhan had just been seen as a person of color. They weren't sure if there were accomplices. And so Acosta was out that night. And Acosta writes this letter of like, this is a tinderbox. LA is about to burn. And Acosta says, I don't know what to make of the desire in me to see the flames, to see it burn. And I don't think that was really as clear, probably, in my opinion, to Thompson until a few months later, when then Thompson was beaten so savagely within Chicago, the Battle of Michigan Avenue in Chicago. But Thompson's response to being beaten up in Chicago was to go back and work within the political system on a local level and do a mayoral campaign in Aspen, and to run for sheriff of Pitkin County. And so it's interesting that while Thompson went to a sort of smaller scale environment to try to affect change, Acosta in East Los Angeles didn't have that option. He didn't have a small mountain community he could band people together in and, you know, try to change for the better. He was living in a barrio of 3 million people that the police continued to oppress. And so their paths really just diverged in this terrifying and fascinating way as the 60s kind of turned into the 70s.
This is a great book. My guest right now is Timothy Devaney, author of Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. We're running up to the top of the hour and the end of the show. I wanted to ask you a fun question to go out on. In your research, why did Hunter find Horatio Alger as a useful literary tool?
Well, people don't know. Horatio Alger is this like terrible, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps character from the I think 19th century. And so you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it ends with him in the Denver airport, and he's like, I felt like a monster reincarnation of Horatio Alger, a man on the move. And what Horatio Alger represents in our society is mobility, is that, you know, the American dream, it's myth that if you work hard enough, you'll get whatever you want. And I think Thompson, as he began to see American injustice and its ingrained power, he saw how that myth was used by the people who had the most to say, well, if you don't have anything, it's because you didn't work hard enough. It's your fault. Just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so, you know, Thompson was so good at not just seeing who had power and how they were abusing it, but seeing the myths and stories in which they rely upon to keep that power structure in place. And so by bringing up Horatio Alger, he's challenging that power structure inherently. Like, you know, Donald Trump believes that he started where everybody else in our society started. And that's not true. But the myth of Horatio Alger holds up Donald Trump as much today as it held up crooked politicians and police officers and generals in the past. And that's something to remember, I think.
Yeah, a $1 million loan turns into feeding his son, Fred Trump, feeding his son millions of dollars from the time he was like 4 years old. Yeah. So my guest for the hour has been Timothy Denevi, author of Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. I just want to thank you for taking time out from your busy day to join us here on KBOO. And thank you for a wonderful read. It's one of my favorite books I've read in a long time.
Well, that's really nice of you to say. Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Oh, you're quite welcome. This is Heather McCoy Show coming up next. Everyone takes their notes with them. It's the Between the Covers. And then music starts at noon. The afternoon PA block starts at 4 p.m. with Democracy Now! This is the Heather McCoy Show. Bye for now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise. This theme addresses the idea that together we rise above the fray of hatred, despair, and discord. The celebration features a job fair, panels, awards, contests, an art gallery, live entertainment, and more. Again, that's the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time now is 10 o'clock. You are listening to, I'm sorry, the time now is 11 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomathon 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Next on Between the Covers, Kenji Lewis, author of Monsters I Have Been, is interviewed.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of SEMA, Sacred Prayer Ceremony of the Whirling Dervishes, on Sunday, June 23rd from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at the Monte Villa United Methodist Church in Portland. SEMA is a ritual of music, poetry, and synchronized movement that embodies the journey of the soul. The Mevlevi Orchestra will accompany the ceremony with authentic classical Turkish SEMA music. Again, that's SEMA, Sacred Prayer Ceremony of the Whirling Dervishes, on Sunday, June 23rd, from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at the Monte Villa United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue.